by himself ranged from 60 to 90%, while those with other people ranged from 30 to 90%. This knowledge strengthened his self-reliance because he realized that he wasn't condemned to misery because he lost his girl, and that he didn't need to depend on others to enjoy himself. You can use the pleasure predicting sheet to test a number of assumptions you might make that lead to procrastination. These include: 1. I can't enjoy anything when I'm alone. 2. There's no point in doing anything because I failed at something important to me. In effect, I didn't get the job or promotion I had my heart set on. 3. Since I'm not rich, successful, or famous, I can't really enjoy things to the hilt. 4. I can't enjoy things unless I'm the center of attention. 5. Things won't be particularly satisfying unless I can do them perfectly or successfully. 6. I wouldn't feel very fulfilled if I did just a part of my work. I've got to get it all done today. All of these attitudes will produce a round of self-fulfilling prophecies if you don't put them to the test. If, however, you check them out using the pleasure predicting sheet, you may be amazed to learn that life can offer you enormous fulfillment. Help yourself. A question that commonly comes up about the pleasure predicting sheet is, suppose I do schedule a number of activities, and I find out they are just as unpleasant as I had anticipated. This might happen. If so, try noting your negative thoughts and write them down, answering them with a daily record of dysfunctional thoughts. For example, suppose you go to a restaurant on your own and feel tense. You might be thinking, these people probably think I'm a loser because I'm here all alone. How would you answer this? You might remind yourself that other people's thoughts do not affect your mood one iota. I have demonstrated this to patients by telling them I will think two thoughts about them for 15 seconds each. One thought will be extremely positive, and the other will be intensely negative and insulting. They are to tell me how each of my thoughts affects them. I close my eyes and think, Jack here is a fine person and I like him. Then I think, Jack is the worst person in Pennsylvania. Since Jack doesn't know which thought is which, they have no effect on him. Does that brief experiment strike you as trivial? It's not, because only your thoughts can ever affect you. For example, if you are in a restaurant feeling miserable because you are alone, you really have no idea what people are thinking. It's your thoughts, and only yours, that are making you feel terrible. You're the only person in the world who can effectively persecute yourself. Why do you label yourself a loser because you're in a restaurant alone? Would you be so cruel to someone else? Stop insulting yourself like that. Talk back to that automatic thought with a rational response. Going to a restaurant alone doesn't make me a loser. I have just as much right to be here as anyone else. If someone doesn't like it, so what? As long as I respect myself, I don't need to be concerned with others' opinions. How to get off your butt, the butt rebuttal. Your butt may represent the greatest obstacle to effective action. The moment you think of doing something productive, you give yourself excuses in the form of buts. For example, I could go out and jog today, but 1. I'm really too tired to. 2. I'm just too lazy. 3. I'm not particularly in the mood, etc. Here's another example. I could cut down on my smoking, but 1. I don't have that kind of self-discipline. 2. I don't really feel like going cold turkey and cutting down gradually would be slow torture. 3. I've been too nervous lately. If you really want to motivate yourself, you'll have to learn how to get off your butt. One way to do this is with the butt rebuttal method, shown in figure 5-6 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. Suppose it's Saturday and you've scheduled mowing the lawn. You procrastinated for 3 weeks and it looks like a jungle. You tell yourself, I really should, but I'm just not in the mood. Record this in the butt column. Now fight back by writing a butt rebuttal. I'll feel more like it once I get started. When I'm done, I'll feel terrific. Your next impulse will probably be to dream up a new objection, but it's so long it will take forever. Now fight back with a new rebuttal as shown in figure 5-6 and continue this process until you've run out of excuses. Learn to endorse yourself. Do you frequently convince yourself that what you do doesn't count? If you have this bad habit, you will naturally feel that you never do anything worthwhile. It won't make any difference if you're a Nobel laureate or a gardener. Life will seem empty because your sour attitude will take the joy out of all your endeavors and defeat you before you even begin. No wonder you feel unmotivated. To reverse this destructive tendency, a good first step would be to pinpoint the self-downing thoughts that cause you to feel this way in the first place. Talk back to these thoughts and replace them with ones that are more objective and self-endorsing. Some examples of this are shown in Figure 5-7 on the enhancement. Once you get the knack of it, practice consciously endorsing yourself all day long for the things you do, even if they seem trivial. You may not feel a pleasant emotional lift in the beginning, but keep practicing, even if it seems mechanical. After a few days, you will begin to experience some mood lift, and you will feel more pride about what you're doing. You may object, "Why should I have to pat myself on the back for everything I do? My family, friends, and business associates should be more appreciative of me." There are several problems here. In the first place, even if people are overlooking your efforts, you are guilty of the same crime if you also neglect yourself, and pouting won't improve the situation. Even when someone does stroke you, you can't absorb the praise unless you decide to believe and therefore validate what is being said. How many genuine compliments fall on your deaf ears because you mentally discredit them? When you do this, other people feel frustrated because you don't respond positively to what they are saying. Naturally, they give up trying to combat your self-downing habit. Ultimately, only what you think about what you do will affect your mood. It can be helpful simply to make a written or mental list of the things you do each day, then give yourself a mental credit for each of them, however small. This will help you focus on what you have done instead of what you haven't gotten around to doing. It may sound simplistic, but it works. Tick-tock technique. If you are procrastinating about getting down to a specific task, take note of the way you are thinking about it. These ticks, or task-interfering cognitions, will lose much of their power over you if you simply write them down and substitute more adaptive TOCs, or task-oriented cognitions, using the double column technique. A number of examples are shown in Figure 5-8 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. When you record your TikToks, be sure to pinpoint the distortion in the tick that defeats you. You may find, for example, that your worst enemy is all-or-nothing thinking or disqualifying the positive, or you may be in the bad habit of making arbitrary negative predictions. Once you become aware of the type of distortion that most commonly thwarts you, you will be able to correct it. Your procrastination and time-wasting will give way to action and creativity. You can also apply this principle to mental images and daydreams as well as to thoughts. When you avoid a task, you probably automatically fantasize about it in a negative, defeatist fashion. This creates unnecessary tension and apprehension, which impairs your performance and increases the likelihood that your dreaded fear will actually come true. For example, if you have to give a speech to a group of associates, you may fret and worry for weeks ahead of time because in your mind's eye, you see yourself forgetting what you have to say or reacting defensively to a pushy question from the audience. By the time you give the speech, you have effectively programmed yourself to behave just this way. And you're such a nervous wreck, it turns out just as badly as you had imagined. If you dare to give it a try, here's a solution. For 10 minutes every night before you go to sleep, practice fantasizing that you deliver the speech in a positive way. Imagine that you appear confident, that you present your material in an energetic manner, and that you handle all questions from the audience warmly and capably. You may be surprised that this simple exercise can go a long way to improving how you feel about what you do. Obviously, there is no guarantee things will always come out exactly as you imagine, but there's no doubt that your expectations and mood will profoundly influence what actually does happen. Little steps for little feet. A simple and obvious self-activation method involves learning to break any proposed task down into its tiny component parts. This will combat your tendency to overwhelm yourself by dwelling on all the things you have to do. Suppose your job involves attending lots of meetings, but you find it difficult to concentrate due to anxiety, depression, or daydreaming. You can't concentrate effectively because you think, "I don't understand this as I should. Gosh, this is boring. I'd really prefer to be making love or fishing right now." Here's how you can beat the boredom, defeat the distraction, and increase your ability to concentrate. Break the task down into its smallest component parts. For example, decide to listen for only 3 minutes and then take a 1 minute break to daydream intensively. At the end of this mental vacation, listen for another 3 minutes and do not entertain any distracting thoughts for this brief period. Then give yourself another 1 minute break to daydream. This technique will enable you to maintain a more effective level of overall concentration. Giving yourself permission to dwell on distracting thoughts for short periods will diminish their power over you. After a while, they will seem ludicrous. An extremely useful way to divide a task into manageable units is through time limitation. Decide how much time you will devote to a particular task, and then stop at the end of the allotted time and go on to something more enjoyable, whether or not you're finished. As simple as this sounds, it can work wonders. For example, the wife of a political VIP spent years harboring resentment toward her husband for his successful, glamorous life. She felt her life consisted of an oppressive load of child-rearing and house-cleaning. Because she was compulsive, she never felt she had enough time to complete her dreary chores. Life was a treadmill. She was straddled by depression and had been unsuccessfully treated by a long string of famous therapists for over a decade as she looked in vain for the elusive key to personal happiness. After consulting twice with one of my colleagues, Dr. Aaron T. Beck, she experienced a rapid mood swing out of her depression. His therapeutic wizardry never ceases to astonish me. How did he perform this seeming miracle? Easy. He suggested to her that her depression was due in part to the fact that she wasn't pursuing goals that were meaningful to her because she didn't believe in herself. Instead of acknowledging and confronting her fear of taking risks, she blamed her lack of direction on her husband and complained about all the undone housework. The first step was to decide how much time she felt she wanted to spend on the housework each day. She was to spend no more than this amount, even if the house wasn't perfect, and she was to budget the rest of the day to pursue activities that interested her. She decided that 1 hour of housework would be fair, and enrolled in a graduate program so she could develop her own career. This gave her a feeling of liberation. Like magic, the depression vanished along with the anger she harbored toward her husband. I don't want to give you the idea that depression is usually so easy to eliminate. Even in the above case, this patient will probably have to fight off a number of depressive recurrences. She may at times fall back temporarily into the same trap of trying to do too much, blaming others, and feeling overwhelmed. Then she will have to apply the same solution again. The important thing is she has found a method that works for her. The same approach might work for you. Do you tend to bite off bigger pieces than you can comfortably chew? Dare to put modest time limits on what you do. Have the courage to walk away from an unfinished task. You may be amazed that you will experience a substantial increase in your productivity and mood, and your procrastination may become a thing of the past. Motivation without coercion. A possible source of your procrastination is an inappropriate system for self-motivation. You may inadvertently undermine what you attempt by flagellating yourself with so many oughts, shoulds, and musts that you end up drained of any desire to get moving. You are defeating yourself by the way you kill yourself to get moving. Dr. Albert Ellis describes this mental trap as musturbation. Reformulate the way you tell yourself to do things by eliminating those coercive words from your vocabulary. An alternative to pushing yourself to get up in the morning would be to say, "It will make me feel better to get out of bed, even though it will be hard at first. Although I'm not obliged to, I might end up being glad I did. If, on the other hand, I'm really benefiting from the rest and relaxation, I may as well go ahead and enjoy it." If you translate shoulds into wants, you will be treating yourself with a sense of respect. This will produce a feeling of freedom of choice and personal dignity. You will find that a reward system works better and lasts longer than a whip. Ask yourself, what do I want to do? What course of action would be to my best advantage? I think you will find that this way of looking at things will enhance your motivation. If you still have the desire to lie in bed, mope, and feel doubtful that getting up is really what you want to do, make a list of the advantages and disadvantages of staying in bed for another day. For example, an accountant who was far behind in his work around tax time found it hard to get up each day. His customers began to complain about the undone work, and in order to avoid these embarrassing confrontations, he'd lay in bed for weeks trying to escape, not even answering the phone. Many customers fired him, and his business began to fail. His mistake was in telling himself, "I know I should go to work, but I don't want to, and I don't have to either, so I won't." Essentially, the word "should" created the illusion that the only reason for him to get out of bed was to please a bunch of angry, demanding customers. This was so unpleasant that he resisted. The absurdity of what he was doing to himself became apparent when he made a list of the advantages and disadvantages of staying in bed. You can take a look at the accountant's list in Figure 5-9 on the enhancement. After preparing this list, he realized it was to his advantage to get out of bed. As he subsequently became more involved with his work, his mood rapidly improved in spite of the fact that he had lost many accounts during the period of inactivity. Disarming technique. Your sense of paralysis will be intensified if your family and friends are in the habit of pushing and cajoling you. Their nagging "should" statements reinforce the insulting thoughts already echoing through your head. Why is their pushy approach doomed to failure? It's a basic law of physics that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Anytime you feel shoved, whether by someone's hand actually on your chest or by someone trying to boss you around, you will naturally tighten up and resist so as to maintain your equilibrium and balance. You will attempt to exert your self-control and preserve your dignity by refusing to do the thing that you are being pushed to do. The paradox is that you often end up hurting yourself. It can be very confusing when someone obnoxiously insists that you do something that actually would be to your advantage. This puts you in a can't-win situation because if you refuse to do what the person tells you, you end up defeating yourself just in order to spite him or her. In contrast, if you do what the person tells you to do, you feel had. Because you gave in to those pushy demands, you get the feeling the individual controlled you, and this robs you of self-respect. No one likes to be coerced. For example, Mary is a woman in her late teens who was referred to us by her parents after many years of depression. Mary was a real hibernator and had the capacity to sit alone in her room watching TV soap operas for months at a time. This was due in part to her irrational belief that she looked peculiar and that people would stare at her if she went out in public, and also by her feeling of being coerced by her domineering mother. Mary admitted that doing things might help her feel better, but this would mean giving in to her mother, who kept telling her to get off her duff and do something. The harder Mom pushed, the more stubbornly Mary resisted. It is an unfortunate fact of human nature that it can be extremely difficult to do something when you sense you are being forced into it. Fortunately, it's very easy to learn how to handle people who nag and harangue you and try to run your life. Suppose you are Mary, and after thinking things over, you decide you would be better off if you got involved in doing a number of things. You've just made this decision when your mother comes into your bedroom and announces, "Don't you lie around any longer. Your life is going down the drain. Get moving. Get involved in things the way the other girls your age do." At that moment, in spite of the fact that you already have decided to do just that, you develop a tremendous aversion to it. The disarming technique is an assertive method that will solve this problem for you. Other applications of this verbal maneuver will be described in the next chapter. The essence of the disarming technique is to agree with your mother, but to do so in a way that you remind her you are agreeing with her based on your own decision and not because she was telling you what to do. So you might answer this way: "Yes, Mom, I just thought the situation over myself and decided it would be to my advantage to get moving on things. Because of my own decision, I'm going to do it." Now you can start doing things and not feel had. Or if you wish to put more of a barb in your comments, you can always say, "Yes, Mom, I have, in fact, decided to get out of bed in spite of the fact that you've been telling me to." Visualize success. A powerful self-motivation method involves making a list of the advantages of a productive action you've been avoiding because it requires more self-discipline than you have been able to muster. Such a list will train you to look at the positive consequences of doing it. It's only human to go after what you want. Furthermore, clubbing yourself into effective action doesn't usually work nearly as well as a fat, fresh carrot. Suppose, for example, you want to quit smoking. You may be reminding yourself about cancer and all the other dangers of smoking. These fear tactics make you so nervous that you immediately reach for another cigarette. They don't work. Here's a three-step method that does work. The first step is to make a list of all the positive consequences that will result when you become a non-smoker. List as many as you can think of, including 1. Improved health. 2. I'll respect myself. 3. I'll have greater self-discipline. With my new self-confidence, I may be able to do a whole lot of other things I've been putting off. 4. I will be able to run and dance actively and still feel good about my body. I'll have lots of stamina and extra energy. 5. My lungs and heart will become strong. My blood pressure will go down. 6. My breath will be fresh. 7. I'll have extra spending money. 8. I'll live longer. 9. The air around me will be clean. 10. I'll be able to tell people that I've become a non-smoker. Once you prepare the list, you're ready for the second step. Every night before you go to sleep, fantasize you are in your favorite spot, walking through the woods in the mountains on a crisp autumn day, or maybe lying on a quiet beach near a crystal blue ocean, with the sun warming your skin. Whatever fantasy you choose, visualize every enjoyable detail as vividly as possible and let your body relax and let go. Allow every muscle to unwind. Let the tension flow out of your arms and legs and leave your body. Notice how your muscles begin to feel limp and loose. Notice how peaceful you feel. Now you are ready for the third step. Fantasize that you are still in that scene, and you have become a non-smoker. Go through your list of benefits and repeat each one to yourself in the following way. Now I have improved health, and I like it. I can run along the beach, and I want this. The air around me is clean and fresh, and I feel good about myself. I respect myself. Now I have greater self-discipline, and I can take on other challenges if I want to. I have extra spending money, etc. This method of habit management through the power of positive suggestion works amazingly well. It enabled me and many of my patients to quit smoking after a single treatment session. You can do it easily, and you'll find it's well worth your efforts. It can be used for self-improvement in losing weight, lawn mowing, getting up on time in the morning, adhering to a jogging routine, or for any other habit you'd like to modify. Count what counts. A 3-year-old boy named Stevie stood by the edge of the children's pool, afraid to jump in. His mother sat in the water in front of him, urging him to take the leap. He held back. She cajoled. The power struggle went on for 30 minutes. Finally, he jumped. The water felt fine. It wasn't so difficult, and there was actually nothing to fear. But his mother's efforts backfired. The unfortunate message imprinted on Stevie's mind was, I have to be pushed before I can do anything risky. I don't have the gumption to jump in on my own like the other kids. His mother and father got the same idea. They began to think, left to his own devices, Stevie would never dare go into the water at all. If he isn't constantly pushed, he'll do nothing by himself. Raising him is going to be a long, hard struggle. Sure enough, as Stevie grew up, the drama was repeated over and over. He had to be persuaded and pushed to go to school, to join the baseball team, to go to parties, and so on. He rarely initiated any action on his own. By the time he was referred to me at age 21, he was chronically depressed, living with his parents and not doing much with his life. He was still waiting around for people to tell him what to do and how to do it. But by now his parents were fed up trying to motivate him. After each therapy session, he would leave the office charged with my enthusiasm to follow through on whatever self-help assignment we had discussed. For example, one week he decided to smile or say hello to 3 people he didn't know as a small first step in breaking his isolation. But the next week, he would come into my office with a drooping head and a sheepish look that let me know he had forgotten to say hello to anyone. Another week, his assignment was to read a 3-page article I had written for a singles magazine on how an unmarried man learned to overcome his loneliness. Steve came back the next week and said he had lost the manuscript before having a chance to read it. Each week as he left, he would feel a great surge of eagerness to help himself. But by the time he was in the elevator, he would know in his heart of hearts that the week's assignment, however simple, would just be too hard to do. What was Stevie's problem? The explanation goes back to that day at the swimming pool. He still carries in his mind the powerfully imprinted idea that I really can't do anything on my own. I'm the kind of guy who's got to be pushed. Because it never occurred to him to challenge this belief, it continued to function as a self-fulfilling prophecy. and he had over 15 years of procrastination to back up his belief that he really was like that. What was the solution? First, Stevie had to become aware of the two mental errors that were the key to his problem, mental filter and labeling. His mind was dominated by thoughts about the various things he put off doing, and he ignored the hundreds of things he did each week that did not involve his being pushed by someone else. "All of that is well and good," Stevie said after we discussed this. "You seem to have explained my problem, and I think that's correct. But how can I change the situation?" The solution turned out to be simpler than he anticipated. I suggested he obtain a wrist counter, as discussed in the last chapter, so that each day he could count the things he did on his own without prodding or encouragement from anyone. At the end of the day, he was to write down the total number of clicks he scored and keep a daily log. Over a several-week period, he began to notice that his daily score increased. Every time he clicked the counter, he reminded himself that he was in control of his life, and in this way he trained himself to notice what he did do. Stevie began to feel increased self-confidence and to view himself as a more capable human being. Does it sound simple? It is. Will it work for you? You probably don't think so, but why not put it to the test? If you have a negative reaction and are convinced the wrist counter won't work for you, why not evaluate your pessimistic prediction with an experiment? Learn to count what counts. You may be surprised at the results. Test your can'ts. An important key to successful self-activation involves learning to adopt a scientific attitude toward the self-defeating predictions you make about your performance and abilities. If you put these pessimistic thoughts to the test, you can discover what the truth is. One common self-defeating thought pattern when you are depressed or procrastinating is to can't yourself every time you think of something productive to do. Perhaps this stems from your fear of being blamed for your do-nothingism. You try to save face by creating the illusion that you are just too inadequate and incompetent to do a single thing. The problem with defending your lethargy in this manner is that you may really start believing what you are telling yourself. If you say, "I can't," over and over often enough, it becomes like a hypnotic suggestion, and after a while you become genuinely convinced you really are a paralytic invalid who can't do anything. Typical can't thoughts include, "I can't cook," "I can't function," "I can't work," "I can't concentrate," "I can't read," "I can't get out of bed," and "I can't clean my apartment." Not only do such thoughts defeat you, they will sour your relationships with those you love because they will see all your "I can't" statements as annoying whining. They won't perceive that it really looks and seems impossible for you to do anything. They will nag you and set up frustrating power struggles with you. An extremely successful cognitive technique involves testing your negative predictions with actual experiments. Suppose, for example, you've been telling yourself, "I'm so upset I can't concentrate well enough to read anything at all." As a way of testing this hypothesis, sit down with today's newspaper and read one sentence, and then see if you can summarize the sentence out loud. You might then predict, "But I could never read and understand a whole paragraph." Again, put this to the test. Read a paragraph and summarize. Many severe chronic depressions have been cracked open with this powerful method. The can't lose system. You may feel hesitant to put your can'ts to the test because you don't want to run the risk of failure. If you don't run any risks, at least you can maintain the secret belief that you're basically a terrific person who's decided, for the time being, not to get involved. Behind your aloofness and lack of commitment lurks a powerful sense of inadequacy and the fear of failure. The can't lose system will help you combat this fear. Make a list of the negative consequences you might have to deal with if you took a risk and actually did fail. Then expose the distortions in your fears and show how you could cope productively even if you did experience a disappointment. The venture that you have been avoiding may involve a financial, personal, or scholastic risk. Remember that even if you do fail, some good can come from it. After all, this is how you learned how to walk. You didn't just jump up from your crib one day and waltz gracefully across the room. You stumbled and fell on your face and got up and tried again. At what age are you suddenly expected to know everything and never make any more mistakes? If you can love and respect yourself in failure, worlds of adventure and new experiences will open up before you, and your fears will vanish. An example of a written can't-lose system is shown in Figure 5.10 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. Don't put the cart before the horse. I'll bet you still may not know for sure where motivation comes from. What, in your opinion, comes first, motivation or action? If you said motivation, you made an excellent logical choice. Unfortunately, you're wrong. Motivation does not come first. Action does. You have to prime the pump. Then you will begin to get motivated, and the fluids will flow spontaneously. Individuals who procrastinate frequently confuse motivation and action. You foolishly wait until you feel in the mood to do something. Since you don't feel like doing it, you automatically put it off. Your error is your belief that motivation comes first, and then leads to activation and success. But it is usually the other way around. Action must come first, and the motivation comes later on. Take this chapter, for example. The first draft of this chapter was overwritten, clumsy, and stale. It was so long and boring that a true procrastinator would never even have the fortitude to read it. The task of revising it seemed to me like trying to go swimming with concrete shoes. When the day I had scheduled for revising it came, I had to push myself to sit down and get started. My motivation was about 1%, and my urge to avoid the task was 99%. What a hideous chore. After I got involved in the task, I became highly motivated, and the job seems easy now. Writing became fun after all. It works like this. First, action. Second, motivation. Third, more action. If you are a procrastinator, you probably aren't aware of this, so you lie around in bed waiting for inspiration to strike. When someone suggests you do something, you whine, "I don't feel like it." Well, who said you were supposed to feel like it? If you wait until you're in the mood, you may wait forever. On the enhancement, Table 5.1 will help you review the various activation techniques and select what's most helpful to you. Chapter 6. Verbal Judo. Learn to talk back when you're under the fire of criticism. You are learning that the cause of your sense of worthlessness is your ongoing self-criticism. This takes the form of an upsetting internal conversation in which you constantly harangue and persecute yourself in a harsh, unrealistic manner. Frequently, your inner criticism will be triggered by someone else's sharp remark. You may dread criticism simply because you have never learned effective techniques for handling it. Because it is relatively easy to do, I want to emphasize the importance of mastering the art of handling verbal abuse and disapproval non-defensively and without a loss of self-esteem. Many depressive episodes are set in motion by external criticism. Even psychiatrists, who are supposedly professional abuse takers, can react adversely to criticism. A psychiatric resident called Art received negative feedback intended to be helpful from his supervisor. A patient had complained that several comments Art made during a therapy session were abrasive. The resident reacted with a wave of panic and depression when he heard this, due to his thought, "Oh God, the truth is out about me. Even my parents can see what a worthless, insensitive person I am. They'll probably kick me out of the residency program and drum me out of the state." Why is criticism so hurtful to some people, while others can remain unperturbed in the face of the most abusive attack? In this chapter, you will learn the secrets of people who face disapproval fearlessly, and you will be shown specific, concrete steps to overcome and eliminate your own exquisite vulnerability to criticism. As you read the following sections, keep this in mind. Overcoming your fear of criticism will require a moderate amount of practice. But it is not difficult to develop and master this skill, and the positive impact on your self-esteem will be tremendous. Before I show you the way out of the trap of crumbling inwardly when criticized, let me show you why criticism is more upsetting to some people than to others. In the first place, you must realize that it is not other people or the critical comments they make that upset you. To repeat, there has never been a single time in your life when the critical comments of some other person upset you, even to a small extent. No matter how vicious, heartless, or cruel those comments may be, they have no power to disturb you or to create even a little bit of discomfort. After reading that paragraph, you may get the impression that I am cracking up, mistaken, highly unrealistic, or some combination thereof. But I assure you, I am not when I say, Only one person in this world has the power to put you down, and you are that person. No one else. Here's how it works. When another person criticizes you, certain negative thoughts are automatically triggered in your head. Your emotional reaction will be created by these thoughts and not by what the other person says. The thoughts which upset you will invariably contain the same types of mental errors described in Chapter 3. Overgeneralization, all-or-nothing thinking, the mental filter, labeling, etc. For example, let's take a look at Art's thoughts. His panic was the result of his catastrophic interpretation. This criticism shows how worthless I am. What mental errors is he making? In the first place, Art is jumping to conclusions when he arbitrarily concludes the patient's criticism is valid and reasonable. This may or may not be the case. Furthermore, he is exaggerating the importance of whatever he actually said to the patient that may have been undiplomatic, magnification, and he is assuming he could do nothing to correct any errors in his behavior, the fortune-teller error. He unrealistically predicted he would be rejected and ruined professionally because he would repeat endlessly whatever error he made with this one patient, overgeneralization. He focused exclusively on his error, the mental filter, and overlooked his numerous other therapeutic successes, disqualifying or overlooking the positive. He identified with his erroneous behavior and concluded he was a worthless and insensitive human being. Labeling. The first step in overcoming your fear of criticism concerns your own mental processes. Learn to identify the negative thoughts you have when you're being criticized. It will be most helpful to write them down using the double-column technique described in the two previous chapters. This will enable you to analyze your thoughts and recognize where your thinking is illogical or wrong. Finally, write down rational responses that are more reasonable and less upsetting. An excerpt from Art's written homework using the double-column technique is included in Figure 6-1 on the enhancement. As he learned to think about the situation in a more realistic manner, he stopped wasting mental and emotional effort and catastrophizing and was able to channel his energy into creative, goal-oriented problem-solving. After evaluating precisely what he had said that was offensive or hurtful, he was able to take steps to modify his clinical style with patients so as to minimize future similar mistakes. As a result, he learned from the situation, and his clinical skills and maturity increased. This gave his self-confidence a boost and helped him overcome his fear of being imperfect. To put it succinctly, if people criticize you, the comments they make will be right or wrong. If the comments are wrong, there is really nothing for you to be upset about. Think about that for a minute. Many patients have come to me in tears, angry and upset because a loved one made a critical comment to them that was thoughtless and inaccurate. Such a reaction is unnecessary. Why should you be disturbed if someone else makes the mistake of criticizing you in an unjust manner? That's the other guy's error, not yours. Why upset yourself? Did you expect that other people would be perfect? On the other hand, if the criticism is accurate, there is still no reason for you to feel overwhelmed. You're not expected to be perfect. Just acknowledge your error and take whatever steps you can to correct it. It sounds simple, and it is, but it may take some effort to transform this insight into an emotional reality. Of course, you may fear criticism because you feel you need the love and approval of other people in order to be worthwhile and happy. The problem with this point of view is that you'll have to devote all your energies to trying to please people, and you won't have much left for creative, productive living. Paradoxically, many people may find you less interesting and desirable than your more self-assured friends. Thus far, what I have told you is a review of the cognitive techniques introduced in the previous chapter. The crux of the matter is that only your thoughts can upset you, and if you learn to think more realistically, you will feel less upset. Right now, write down the negative thoughts that ordinarily go through your head when someone criticizes you. Then identify the distortions and substitute more objective, rational responses. This will help you feel less angry and threatened. Now, I would like to teach you some simple verbal techniques which may have considerable practical relevance. What can you say when someone is attacking you? How can you handle these difficult situations in a way that will enhance your sense of mastery and self-confidence? Step 1. Empathy. When someone is criticizing or attacking you, his or her motives may be to help you or to hurt you. What the critic says may be right or wrong or somewhere in between, but it is not wise to focus on these issues initially. Instead, ask the person a series of specific questions designed to find out exactly what he or she means. Try to avoid being judgmental or defensive as you ask the questions. Constantly ask for more and more specific information. Attempt to see the world through the critic's eyes. If the person attacks you with vague, insulting labels, ask him or her to be more specific and to point out exactly what it is about you the person dislikes. This initial maneuver can itself go a long way to getting the critic off your back and will help transform an attack-defense interaction into one of collaboration and mutual respect. I often illustrate how to do this in a therapy session by role-playing an imaginary situation with the patient so that I can model this particular skill. I'll show you how to role-play. It's a useful skill to develop. In the dialogue that follows, I want you to imagine you are an angry critic. Say the most brutal and upsetting thing to me you can think of. What you say can be true, false, or partly both. I will respond to each of your assaults with the empathy technique. You, playing the role of angry critic. Dr. Burns, you are a no good shit. David, what about me is shitty? Everything you say and do, you're insensitive, self-centered, and incompetent. Let's take each of these. I want you to try to be specific. Apparently, I've done or said a number of things that upset you. Just what did I say that sounded insensitive? What gave you the impression I was self-centered? What did I do that seemed incompetent? When I called you to change my appointment the other day, you sounded rushed and irritable, as if you were in a big hurry and didn't give a damn about me. Okay, I came across in a rushed, uncaring way on the phone. What else have I done that irritated you? You always seemed to hurry me out at the end of the session, just like this was a big production line to make money. Okay. I've been too rushed during sessions as well. I may have given you the impression I'm more interested in your money than in you. What else have I done? Can you think of other ways I might have goofed up or offended you? What I'm doing is simple. By asking you specific questions, I minimize the possibility that you will reject me completely. You and I become aware of some specific concrete problems that we can deal with. Furthermore, I am giving you your day in court by listening to you so as to understand the situation as you see it. This tends to diffuse any anger and hostility and introduces a problem-solving orientation in the place of blame-casting or debate. Remember the first rule. Even if you feel the criticism is totally unjust, respond with empathy by asking specific questions. Find out precisely what your critic means. If the person is very hot under the collar, he or she may be hurling labels at you, perhaps even obscenities. Nevertheless, ask for more information. What do those words mean? Why does the person call you a no-good shit? How did you offend this individual? What did you do? When did you do it? How often have you done it? What else does the person dislike about you? Find out what your action means to him or her. Try to see the world through your critic's eyes. This approach will frequently calm the roaring lion and lay the groundwork for a more sensible discussion. Step 2. Disarming the critic. If someone is shooting at you, you have three choices. You can stand and shoot back. This usually leads to warfare and mutual destruction. You can run away or try to dodge the bullets. This often results in humiliation and the loss of self-esteem. Or you can stay put and skillfully disarm your opponent. I have found that this third solution is by far the most satisfying. When you take the wind out of the other person's sails, you end up the winner, and your opponent more often than not will also feel like a winner. How is this accomplished? It's simple. Whether your critic is right or wrong, initially find some way to agree with him or her. Let me illustrate the easiest situation first. Let's assume the critic is primarily correct. In the previous example, when you angrily accused me of sounding rushed and indifferent on several occasions, I might go on to say, "You're absolutely right. I was rushed when you called, and I probably did sound impersonal. Other people have also pointed this out to me at times. I want to emphasize that I didn't intend to hurt your feelings. You're also right that we have been rushed during several of our sessions. You might recall that sessions can be any length you like, as long as we decide this ahead of time, so that the scheduling can be appropriately adjusted. Perhaps you'd like to schedule sessions that are 15 or 30 minutes longer and see if that's more comfortable." Now, suppose the person who's attacking you is making criticisms you feel are unfair and not valid. What if it would be unrealistic for you to change? How can you agree with someone when you feel certain that what is being said is utter nonsense? It's easy. You can agree in principle with the criticism, or you can find some grain of truth in the statement and agree with that. Or you can acknowledge that the person's upset is understandable because it is based on how he or she views the situation. I can best illustrate this by continuing the role-playing. You attack me, but this time say things that are primarily false. According to the rules of the game, I must, 1, find some way to agree with whatever you say, 2, avoid sarcasm or defensiveness, 3, always speak the truth. Your statements can be as bizarre and as ruthless as you like, and I guarantee I will stick by these rules. Let's go. You, continuing to play the role of angry critic. Dr. Burns, you're a shit. David, I feel that way at times. I often goof up at things. You, this cognitive therapy is no damn good. There's certainly plenty of room for improvement. And you're stupid. There are lots of people who are brighter than I am. I'm sure not the smartest person in the world. You have no real feelings for your patients. Your approach to therapy is superficial and gimmicky. I'm not always as warm and open as I'd like to be. Some of my methods might seem gimmicky at first. You're not a real psychiatrist. This book is pure trash. You're not trustworthy or competent to manage my case. I'm terribly sorry I seem incompetent to you. It must be quite disturbing to you. You seem to find it difficult to trust me, and you are genuinely skeptical about whether we can work together effectively. You're absolutely right. We can't work together successfully unless we have a sense of mutual respect and teamwork. By this time or sooner, the angry critic will usually lose steam. Because I do not fight back, but instead find a way to agree with my opponent, the person quickly seems to run out of ammunition, having been successfully disarmed. You might think of this as winning by avoiding battle. As the critic begins to calm down, he or she will be in a better mood to communicate. Once I have demonstrated these first two steps to a patient in my office, I usually propose we reverse roles to give the patient the chance to master the method. Let's do this. I will criticize and attack you, and you will practice the empathy and make up your own answers. Then see how closely they are accurate or nonsensical. To make the following dialogue a more useful exercise, cover up the responses called you and make up your own answers. Then see how closely they correspond with what I have written. Remember to ask questions using the empathy method and find valid ways to agree with me using the disarming technique. David, playing the role of angry critic. You're not here to get better. You're just looking for sympathy. You, playing the role of one under attack. What gives you the impression I'm just looking for sympathy? David. You don't do anything to help yourself between sessions. All you want to do is come here and complain. It's true that I haven't been doing some of the written homework you suggested. Do you feel I shouldn't complain during sessions? You can do whatever you want. Just admit you don't give a damn. You mean you think I don't want to get better or what? You're no good. You're just a piece of garbage. I've been feeling that way for years. Do you have some ideas about what I can do to feel differently? I give up. You win. You're right. I did win. I strongly suggest you practice this with a friend. The role-playing format will help you master the necessary skills needed when a real situation arises. If there is no one you feel comfortable with who could role-play with you effectively, a good alternative would be to write out imaginary dialogues between you and a hostile critic, similar to the ones you've been reading. After each harangue, write down how you might answer using the empathy and disarming technique. It may seem difficult at first, but I think you'll catch on quite readily. It's really quite easy once you get the gist of it. You will notice you have a profound, almost irresistible tendency to defend yourself when you are unjustly accused. This is a major mistake. If you give in to this tendency, you will find that the intensity of your opponent's attack increases. You will paradoxically be adding bullets to that person's arsenal every time you defend yourself. For example, you be the critic again, and this time I'll defend myself against your absurd accusations. You'll see how quickly our interaction will escalate to full-scale warfare. You, in the role of critic again. Dr. Burns, you don't care about your patients. David, responding in a defensive manner. That's untrue and unfair. You don't know what you're talking about. My patients respect all the hard work I put in. Well, here's one who doesn't. Goodbye. You exit, having decided to fire me. My defensiveness leads to a total loss. In contrast, if I respond with empathy and disarm your hostility, more often than not, you will feel I am listening to you and respecting you. As a result, you lose your ardor to do battle and quiet down. This paves the way for step 3, feedback and negotiation. You may find initially that in spite of your determination to apply these techniques, when a real situation arises in which you are criticized, you will be caught up by your emotions and your old behavior patterns. You may find yourself sulking, arguing, defending yourself vehemently, etc. This is understandable. You're not expected to learn it all overnight, and you don't have to win every battle. It is important, however, to analyze your mistakes afterward so that you can review how you might have handled the situation differently along the lines suggested. It can be immensely helpful to find a friend to role-play the difficult situation with you afterward so that you can practice a variety of responses until you have mastered an approach you are comfortable with. Step 3. Feedback and negotiation. Once you have listened to your critic using the empathy method and disarmed him by finding some way to agree with him, you will then be in a position to explain your position and emotions tactfully but assertively and to negotiate any real differences. Let's assume that the critic is just plain wrong. How can you express this in a non-destructive manner? This is simple. You can express your point of view objectively with an acknowledgement you might be wrong. Make the conflict one based on fact rather than personality or pride. Avoid directing destructive labels at your critic. Remember, his error does not make him stupid, worthless, or inferior. For example, a patient recently claimed that I sent a bill for a session for which she had already paid. She assaulted me with, "Why don't you get your bookkeeping straight?" Knowing she was in error, I responded, "My records may indeed be wrong. I seem to recall that you forgot your checkbook that day, but I might be confused on this point. I hope you'll allow for the possibility that you or I will make errors at times. Then we can be more relaxed with each other. Why not see if you have a canceled check? That way we can find out the truth and make appropriate adjustments." In this case, my non-polarizing response allowed her to save face and avoided a confrontation in which her self-respect was at risk. Although it turned out she was wrong, she later expressed relief that I acknowledged I do make mistakes. This helped her feel better about me, as she was afraid I would be as perfectionistic and demanding with her as she was with herself. Sometimes you and the critic will differ not on a matter of fact, but of taste. Once again, you will be a winner if you present your point of view with diplomacy. For example, I have found that no matter how I dress, some patients respond favorably and some negatively. I feel most comfortable in a suit and tie or in a sports coat and tie. Suppose a patient criticizes me because my clothes are too formal and this is irritating because it makes me appear to be part of the establishment. After eliciting further specific information about other things this person might dislike about me, I could then respond, "I can certainly agree with you that suits are a bit formal. You would be more comfortable with me if I dressed more casually. I'm sure you'll understand that after dressing in a variety of ways, I have found that a nice suit or sports coat is most acceptable to the majority of the people I work with, and that's why I've decided to stick with this style of dressing. I'm hopeful you won't let this interfere with our continued work together." You have a number of options when you negotiate with the critic. If he or she continues to harangue you, making the same point again and again, you can simply repeat your assertive response politely, but firmly, over and over until the person tires out. For example, if my critic continued to insist I stop wearing suits, I might continue to say each time, "I understand your point entirely, and there is some truth to it. Nevertheless, I've decided to stick with more formal attire at this time." Sometimes the solution will be in between. In this case, negotiation and compromise are indicated. You may have to settle for part of what you want. But if you have conscientiously applied the empathy and disarming techniques first, you will probably get more of what you want. In many cases, you will be just plain wrong and the critic will be right. In such a situation, your critic's respect for you will probably increase by an orbital jump if you assertively agree with the criticism, thank the person for providing you with the information, and apologize for any hurt you might have caused. It sounds like old-fashioned common sense, and it is, but it can be amazingly effective. By now you may be saying, "But don't I have a right to defend myself when someone criticizes me? Why should I always have to empathize with the other person? After all, he may be the ninny, not I. Isn't it human just to get angry and blow your stack? Why should I always have to smooth things out?" Well, there is considerable truth in what you say. You do have the right to defend yourself vigorously from criticism and to get angry at anyone you choose whenever you like. And you are right on target when you point out that it is often your critic and not you whose thinking is fouled up. And there is more than a grain of truth behind the slogan, better mad than sad. After all, if you're going to conclude that someone is no damn good, why not let it be the other fellow? And furthermore, sometimes it does feel so much better to be mad at the other person. Many psychotherapists would agree with you on this point. Freud felt that depression was anger turned inward. In other words, he believed depressed individuals direct their rage against themselves. In keeping with this view, many therapists urge their patients to get in touch with their anger and to express it more frequently to others. They might even say that some of the methods described in this section amount to a repressive cop-out. This is a false issue. The crucial point is not whether or not you express your feelings, but the manner in which you do it. If your message is, "I'm angry because you're criticizing me and you're no damn good," you will poison your relationship with that person. If you defend yourself from negative feedback in a defensive and vengeful way, you will reduce the prospect for productive interaction in the future. Thus, while your angry outburst momentarily feels good, you may defeat yourself in the long run by burning your bridges. You have polarized the situation prematurely and unnecessarily, and eliminated your chance to learn what the critic was trying to convey. And what is worse, you may experience a depressive backlash and punish yourself inordinately for your burst of temper. Anti-heckler technique. A specialized application of the techniques discussed in this chapter might be particularly helpful for those of you who are involved in lecturing or teaching. I developed the anti-heckler technique when I began lecturing to university and professional groups on current depression research. Although my lectures are usually well received, I occasionally find there is a single heckler in the audience. The heckler's comments usually have several characteristics. One, they are intensely critical, but seem inaccurate or irrelevant to the material presented. Two, they often come from a person who is not well accepted or regarded among his or her local peers. And three, they are expressed in a haranguing, abusive style. I therefore had to develop an anti-heckler technique which I could use to silence such a person in an inoffensive manner so that the rest of the audience could have an equal opportunity to ask questions. I find that the following method is highly effective. 1. I immediately thank the person for his or her comments. 2. Acknowledge that the points brought up are indeed important. And 3. I emphasize that there is a need for more knowledge about the points raised, and I encourage my critic to pursue meaningful research and investigation on the topic. Finally, I invite the heckler to share his or her views with me further after the close of the session. Although no verbal technique is guaranteed to bring a particular result, I have rarely failed to achieve a favorable effect when using this upbeat approach. In fact, these heckling individuals have frequently approached me after the lecture to compliment and thank me for my kind comments. It is sometimes the heckler who turns out to be the most demonstrative and appreciative of my lecture. Summary. The various cognitive and verbal principles for coping with criticism are summarized in Figure 6-2 on the enhancement. As a general rule, when someone insults you, you will immediately go down one of three pathways: the sad route, the mad route, or the glad route. Whichever option you choose will be a total experience and will involve your thinking, your feelings, your behavior, and even the way your body functions. Most people with a tendency to depression choose the sad route. You automatically conclude the critic is right. Without any systematic investigation, you jump to the conclusion that you were in the wrong and made a mistake. You then magnify the importance of the criticism with a series of thinking errors. You might overgeneralize and wrongly conclude that your whole life consists of nothing but a string of errors. Or you might label yourself a total goof-up. And because of your perfectionistic expectation that you are supposed to be flawless, you will probably feel convinced that your presumed error indicates you are worthless. As a result of these mental errors, you will experience depression and a loss of self-esteem. Your verbal responses will be ineffectual and passive, characterized by avoidance and withdrawal. In contrast, you may choose the mad route. You will defend yourself from the horrors of being imperfect by trying to convince the critic that he or she is a monster. You will stubbornly refuse to admit any error because, according to your perfectionistic standards, this would be tantamount to admitting you are a worthless worm. So you hurl accusations back on the assumption that the best defense is a good offense. Your heart beats rapidly and hormones pour into your bloodstream as you prepare for battle. Every muscle tightens and your jaws are clenched. You may feel a temporary exhilaration as you tell your critic off in self-righteous indignation. You'll show him what a no-good piece of crap he is. Unfortunately, he doesn't agree, and in the long run, your outburst is self-defeating because you poisoned the relationship. The third option requires that you either have a self-esteem or at least act as if you did. It is based on the premise that you are a worthwhile human being.